Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. We want to thank Zoetis for sponsoring this wonderful conversation as we talk about canine osteoarthritis, early signs, late care, and closing the OA gap in dogs. And joining us is our wonderful colleague, Dr. Michaela Mayland in the house. How are you, my friend?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, I'm really excited to chat more and dive into this conversation because, my gosh, I mean, in GP world, we see it every day. We talk about this all the time. So it's really good just to get really good information, education on what's the latest and greatest out there. A little bit of information about our phenomenal colleague, Dr. May Lynch. She was born and raised in the beautiful state of Colorado. However, her studies have led her all over the country. She completed a bachelor's in biology and anthrozoology from Carroll College in Montana before completing her DVM at University of Minnesota. Go, what's the mascot?
Golden Gophers.
There it is. Golden Gophers. All right. I was a Cyclones right below you there. So, yeah. During her time in vet school, she served on the chapter board as well as the national board of the Veterinary Business Management Association and was the president of the student chapter of the American Association of Equine Practitioners. She then completed a year-long rotating internship in Los Angeles before heading to the University of Missouri for a surgical oncology internship. Dr. Maylin received her surgical residency training at Cornell University. Her publications range from mapping of the facial planes for oncologic resection to analyzing demographics of residency applicants. After residency, she held a position as a staff surgeon at Alameda East Veterinary Hospital in Colorado. She's thrilled to have joined the Zoetis specialist team in February of 2025. Dr. Maylin calls Franktown, Colorado, her home base where she lives with her husband, three warm-blooded horses, three cats, and her 14 years young Labrador retriever, Denali. Oh my gosh. Shout out to Denali.
Hey, and still going strong. So far, so good.
Right. Well, we talked before we recorded that there are no rules for our senior pets when they're in their gray muzzle years. I love that. All right. So speaking of our gray muzzles and you know, even early aged now, what is osteoarthritis and why do dogs get it?
Yeah. So osteoarthritis in its definition is a degenerative joint disease that can affect all different tissues of the joint itself. Historically, we always thought of it as like a wear and tear condition that was generally associated with aging. But what we know now is that it really is a disease of the entire joint. It includes the bone, cartilage, ligaments, even the fat and tissues lining the joint, the synovium. So osteoarthritis can actually in and of itself degrade the cartilage, change the bone shape, cause inflammation. And the result of that generally is that we see clinically is going to be pain, stiffness, and loss of mobility. But realistically, it is a whole joint disease involving every tissue there.
Yeah. Yep. And how common is it?
So, I mean, it's funny because I feel like we're finally starting to recognize it a little bit better, but the overall commonality of it is vastly underestimated. Despite being like commonly associated with older animals, there's actually a recent study by Enomoto et al. That was looking at the prevalence of osteoarthritis in younger dogs. So they were looking at dogs 8 months to 4 years old, and they found that about 40% of those animals had radiographic signs of osteoarthritis in at least one joint. That being said, there's another study that shows that radiographic evidence of osteoarthritis correlates poorly with some of the clinical limb function that we can see with osteoarthritis. So that highlights that there's like a limitation to just looking at the radiographic component. But if you do look at it from a clinical standpoint in that Enomoto study, they found that about 24% of the dogs had clinical signs of osteoarthritis in that young age window. So now we're looking at a corresponding overlap of radiographic osteoarthritis and joint pain. Those dogs are the truly affected dogs in a very young window. So I know you're probably sitting here thinking, well, yeah, right. Those are young dogs. Those are not the dogs that get osteoarthritis. But I challenge you to think about some of the patients in my own clinical practice that are being referred to my orthopedic surgery service. We're talking about a younger subset of dogs, right? The dogs that come to me for elbow dysplasia, the dogs that come for hip dysplasia, or the cruciates that can happen. I've treated cruciates as young as 9 months old, as old as 16 years old, and the majority of them still fall into that younger age category, around 4 to 5 years old, that we're starting to see them for their cruciate ligament disease. So when I look at those numbers and see dogs that are affected in that, 24% of both clinical and radiographic, 40% radiographic, 8 months to 4 years, I go, hey, that's my population of dogs. So
Yeah.
I really do think we're still underestimating the prevalence of it overall. I think if we can start to recognize it in these younger dogs, we'll get better at actually getting the numbers that exist and actually know how common it is.
Yeah, it is common, and it's something that I mean, I didn't hear this that often, even just a few years ago, let alone that what we're seeing now. And why should this be alarming to veterinary healthcare professionals?
Oh man, I mean, when you think about the number of dogs that are coming in through your practice on a day-to-day basis, there is a statistic out there that 25% of the dogs that have osteoarthritis are not being diagnosed with it. That's a quarter of the dogs that come into your practice and then leave that have a condition, a verifiable painful condition that's not being treated. So when we start to look at that, I mean, we're as a profession, we're not doing our due diligence. We've taken that oath of do no harm and is not doing anything causing harm. There's that potential concern for me that absolutely, if we're not diagnosing it, we're not treating it, we're not doing the best for the animals.
And what can we do to make the diagnosis earlier?
Yeah, so I think as veterinary professionals, knowing what we know now, statistically speaking, we actually have to rewire our brains just a little bit to start recognizing some of these dogs outside of the typical criteria, right? If I were to tell you right now, envision for me, if you will, your like absolute perfect, quote unquote, osteoarthritis patient. I guarantee you just pictured a white muzzled older dog that's muscle wasted, that has some poor mobility, right? Like that's the dog that comes to our minds, but we need to broaden what we think of and not just lump it into this age or breed prevalence categories. So my challenge to the profession is to challenge your thoughts on age, right? We just talked about the fact that it's not just in old dogs, but any inciting injury to that joint can set off this cascade of events that leads to osteoarthritis. So puppies should be evaluated at young ages for that risk of reduced range of motion of their elbows or hips that might even indicate that we've got hip dysplasia or elbow dysplasia at a very young age to know that, hey, this dog might be at a greater risk. But it's not just age. We also have to think outside the size box, right? I guarantee you, the dog you probably just thought of in your brain was a large breed dog, right? Your classic Labrador, German Shepherd dog, right? But I'm not convinced every little dog is born a land shark. I do think there's many little dogs that have underdiagnosed orthopedic conditions and osteoarthritis pain than we're actually giving them credit for. So for a dog that is especially small, has any sort of behavior change, right? Was great being picked up and now we're not. Was great with kids and now we're not. We forget sometimes that behavior changes can absolutely be associated with pain in our pets. So things I want to challenge the veterinary profession to think broader about is think broader about your age, broader about the size and breed of dog you're thinking of, and really evaluate those behavioral changes that you're seeing at home. That can even be for like the happy, family-loving Labrador. If suddenly they're not cuddling as much with the family or not super excited to go on walks, those are behavior changes that should be setting off those little red flags to say, maybe there's some osteoarthritis or some pain in this pet that we need to evaluate for. And then we can capture more of those patients that actually have osteoarthritis.
And what tools do you use?
I'm a big fan of using the Canine OA checklist. Are you familiar with that
Yes.
resource at all? Yeah.
Love
So
it.
it's a published checklist. You can find it online. I know for sure you can find it at librellavetteam.com. I have it as a QR code, which is nice because you can have the QR code owners can scan it and look at it right on their phone. Or sometimes I print it off and laminate it so that I can just clean the page off. How I use this is that very often I just need to owners have some exposure to what to look for at home. Because realistically, who sees the pet the most? I hope it's the owner, right? I hope it's not the veterinary team. And so if owners can actually self-recognize a little bit for us at home to say, hey, I'm seeing some of those changes we talked about, I introduce it to them on day one that I'm seeing them for whatever orthopedic condition I'm going to see them for. So if I'm seeing them for a TPLO, we're sure as heck going to talk about that canine OA checklist on day one. There may not be anything to check off on that list on that day. But when they go home from their surgery, and in a few months, even a few years after that, I am expecting that pet to develop some osteoarthritis. And I want the owners to be able to recognize and say, oh, wow, my dog really does seem to be slowing down now. We're not as quick to rise. We're doing the stairs a little bit slower. We're not jumping on and off the couch or in and out of the car quite like we were before. Those are the things I want to trigger that owner to bring that pet back to me so that I can evaluate them. So it all starts with that checklist and their ability to recognize some of those behaviors at home that are listed on the list.
Excellent. And let's talk about treatment. When, how to intervene to slow clinical progression.
Oh, yeah. So it's funny because as I think back on this, I'm pretty sure I was doing this wrong for most of my career until I really kind of started to evaluate what was published out there. And what changed my mind mostly was the AAHA pain management guidelines that were published in 2022. So what those guidelines demonstrate is essentially tiers of treatment therapies for chronic osteoarthritis pain management. And if you look at it, in tier one, we have the recommended pharmaceutical interventions for chronic osteoarthritis pain is going to be NSAIDs or a monoclonal antibody. They also have in that first tier is essentially keeping pets as active as possible. So they list a couple of things: weight management, exercise, what's it called? Modification of the home to permit that sort of activity. So there's a lot within that tier one, and I wasn't necessarily doing that the right direction, right? I was starting with a lot of my tier two therapies, going, oh, well, you're early osteoarthritis, you're not so bad. I'm not too worried about you. I'm going to reach to these second tier type therapies because we're not too bad. The downside in doing that is I realized because we have so much that we should be doing to manage osteoarthritis, right? We need to get these pets active. We need to get them out for walks. We need to do exercise, physical therapy, weight loss. Those are all things we realistically may not be able to do until we have a pet that's comfortable enough to do them. So, step one, truly step one of any osteoarthritis management is comfort, picking the most appropriate analgesic for that pet. Not only to one, get them comfortable, pain-free, but to then get them up and active so that we can do that weight loss, so that we can start to check off all those other things on the list that we should be doing. So I always start with what is going to be my pain management plan for this pet. And again, according to the AAHA pain management guidelines, they'd be recommending in our first tier an NSAID or monoclonal antibody. So that's realistically the decision I'm making for pets when I'm looking at their chronic osteoarthritis pain is which one of these therapies is going to be the best modality for this dog going forward, then implementing that plan and then all the other components of weight loss and exercise.
Well, movement is medicine, right? I mean, that's a big component to what we're chatting about.
Oh, absolutely. That if we can keep them active, we can combat the muscle atrophy, we can maintain joint range of motion. But again, in order to inspire that activity, we really do have to decide what's going to be the most appropriate analgesic to get them comfortable enough to do the activity we want.
Okay, awesome. And I'm curious to get, what are your top choices for pain control in dogs with osteoarthritis?
Yeah, so once I've truly diagnosed osteoarthritis, I'm really reaching to, am I going to be using an NSAID or a monoclonal antibody for managing this pet long term? There are reasons that I might pick one over the other based on both the owner, the patient factors that I have in front of me, and every patient is a little bit different. So there's not one cut and dry therapy for every single pet. It's going to be absolutely a tailored plan for each pet, and it's something that we can also change going forward in the future. Just because we've picked one thing doesn't mean that that's the only thing that we get to do for that dog. We can always add in those additional tier two therapies. We might need to make other modifications for them as we go through, and I'm constantly monitoring their weight as we go because that will make a big difference. Statistically, if we can get a 7% weight loss in an overweight pet, we can see a benefit in the change of lameness score. So that's like 1 point on the BCS scale. If we can help take a dog from a 7 out of 9 to a 6 out of 9, we should see an improvement in their lameness. So I'm always monitoring their weight as that component. I know your question was, what am I picking pharmaceutically? But I'm never going to pick something pharmaceutically and not pair it with a weight loss plan if they're overweight.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And what about some of the evidence-based supplement administration out there?
Yeah, so what we have the best evidence for is going to be our omega-3 fatty acids. Those now are actually in some diets. There's a few diets or some weight loss diets out there that have it, but then there's some joint specific diets. Those have been validated to have the appropriate concentration of omega-3 fatty acids if fed based on the weight for that dog. That being said, especially when we are talking about some of our geriatric patients, there may be something or a specific diet that some of these dogs have to be on that won't be supplemented with omega-3 fatty acids. Take my dog, for instance. She has copper hepatopathy. She eats a liver diet. There is no liver diet that I've been able to find that has omega-3 fatty acid supplementation. So I have to find an outside source for that. There are so many out there on the market. What I do caution, and maybe caution's not the right word, but I want owners to be able to check the dosing for which they're giving their dog. If you were to look at most of the dosings on those supplements and then actually look at what they need from the omega-3 fatty acid standpoint, the DHA and the EPA, they actually need a lot more to have benefit at the level of the joint. The best way to figure out exactly how much the dog should be eating, I highly recommend going to the CSU website. If you literally Google CSU omega-3 fatty acids, there's a lovely website that you can put in the weight of the pet and it will calculate for you the amount of EPA and DHA that that pet should be receiving. You can then actually look at the bottle and do the math, which is really nice because you'll realize you probably have to increase the dose of what it just says on the bottle to see that efficacy at the level of the joint.
Really helpful. And I know a lot of veterinarians reference the AHA guidelines for NSAIDs or anti-nerve growth factors and monoclonal antibodies, right?
Yeah, so of course, our NSAIDs are going to include many different options at this point. And then from a monoclonal antibody standpoint, we have Librela or the bevacizumab injection, which is actually the first drug in its class that's been approved by the FDA for use in dogs. And we have beautiful statistics demonstrating improvement in quality of life with use of this medication. And we've administered over 35 million doses worldwide at this point.
Wow, fantastic. Okay, so final thoughts for our listeners. Are there any courses or materials to help support the diagnostic journey of dogs with OA?
Yeah, so I know we talked earlier about in general, we need to be better about recognizing which of these dogs there are, and that's where that OA checklist can absolutely come into play. But then I think as, a caregiver or a veterinary practitioner, sometimes you get to that point of, well, now I know I need to do the orthopedic exam on this dog, but like that means I have to do the orthopedic exam on this dog. And that can be really intimidating if it's not something that you do every day or that you haven't done since vet school. So we have tried really hard to put together some resources for people to tap into, especially in these circumstances, right? Maybe you want to get better at doing the orthopedic exam in general. Maybe you want to get better at teasing out is what I'm seeing orthopedic versus neurologic. So we have actually put together a number of videos for this. So if you go to LibrellaVetTeam.com, you can access most of these. But there is a course on ortho versus neuro that is actually a free 1 hour CE that is RACE approved. So that is a great thing if you need to get more hours of CE. But we also have videos on doing both the orthopedic exam and then what I call the northopedic exam, which is an orthopedic exam paired with a neuro exam. So doing our true neuropedics, which can again help us tease that out. We also have the care course, which again is linked, I believe, on LibrellaVetTeam.com for access. As far as resources to utilize in your practice every single day, that OA checklist. And then we also have, if you go to isitoa.com, another checklist that you can go through as you're doing your orthopedic exam to help tease out, well, is this osteoarthritis that I'm seeing, or is it potentially something else? Just another way to help benefit doing that orthopedic exam in the practice. In practice, I also highly recommend taking videos of dogs. As far as I'm concerned, a well-done video can be just as important in the medical record as a baseline radiograph. It's something you can go back and reference. You can see if this dog is worsening over time or improving over time. And now, with most electronic medical records, it's so easy to take a video right from your phone and just zoop, upload it into the medical record and have it there forever to go back to. So I highly recommend doing that or having owners even send videos from home. So there's lots of resources that you can actually kind of utilize in your practice, but also to help train you if you're at the point where you're like, well, I really want to get better at doing this. How do I do it? These videos will be great help.
Fantastic, fantastic information. So good. Dr. Michaela Malin, thank you so much for joining us. Wonderful conversation. Thank you to our friends at Zoetis for sponsoring this great conversation. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everyone. Librela important safety information. Librela is for use in dogs only. Women who are pregnant, trying to conceive, or breastfeeding should take extreme care to avoid self-injection. Hypersensitivity reactions, including anaphylaxis, could potentially occur with self-injection. Librela should not be used in breeding, pregnant, or lactating dogs. Librela should not be administered to dogs with known hypersensitivity to Betaine/Vetmed. Adverse events reported post-approval include ataxia, lack of balance, coordination, anorexia, loss of appetite, lethargy, tiredness, emesis, vomiting, and polydipsia, increased drinking. The most common adverse events reported in the clinical study were urinary tract infections, bacteria skin infections, and dermatitis, skin irritation, inflammation. For complete safety information, refer to the full prescribing information at LibrellaPI.com. Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.